This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Way back in the 80s, when poet Henry Taylor won his Pulitzer, I interviewed him for NPR. And during that conversation, Henry described a famous poet as a poet some of whose work has been read by other poets. So if you kind of shy away from poetry, you've got a lot of company. But I challenge you to stay tuned to The Spark anyway, because I think you'll enjoy hearing what Nathaniel Perry has to say, even though he's a poet, and he's talking about
poetry. Poetry in motion.
50% of the people, if I say, oh, I talked to a poet today for The Spark, they're going to not rock and roll with enthusiasm.
No.
As a poet, do you think poetry is for everyone?
Definitely. Absolutely.
Why has it got such a bad,
lukewarm
reception?
Oh, I'd have to give you a lecture to tell you that. But I think our educational system is the way it teaches English and poetry especially is that poetry is a kind of puzzle to be solved, like a code to be cracked. When really poetry is more like music, something to be just be enjoyed. And there's a lot about Bach that I don't understand, but that doesn't make me not enjoy the music. And I feel like people feel, for whatever reason with poetry, that they can either have to understand all of it or it's not for them. And a lot of that involves this kind of little lecture on literary history, that in the early 20th century, the modernist art movement sort of pulled poetry away and art away from the general populace. You know, I mean, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in the 19th century was one of the best-selling authors, period, of the 19th century, not just of poetry. He sold, I think, The Courtship of Miles Standish, one of his second long poem that he published, sold 20,000 copies in one day in London when it was published.
Is that Speak for Yourself? Is that what that's from?
Yes. Speak for Yourself, John Alden. That's right. You know, in the 19th century, poetry was aimed at the reading public. Now, granted, the reading public was mostly educated and relatively elite people, but poetry was not considered in any way separate from other things that people read. And with modernism, with the war, all of the sort of emotional...
Which war?
World War One. With the emotionality of the Romantic movement, it became untrustworthy. Modernists said, we don't trust... You can't talk about your emotions in a poem because it's not real. The only way something's real is if it's in a thing, right? An image. And the image will then evoke an emotion. And that you can see that moves quickly towards, well, then here's this thing, and what I really mean is inside it. So it's a puzzle. And so poetry becomes a kind of puzzle. Where really poetry is all about just sound and language and meaning sort of all wrapped up, and anyone who can read should be able to enjoy poetry. It's really just a handful of elitist white men that made that con job happen, really. I'm talking about really Eliot and Pound are the two main figures of the modernist movement, both of whom, well, Pound didn't write very many good poems, but he did some lovely translations, and Eliot wrote some wonderful poems. But other writers writing at the same time are somebody like Robert Frost, who was also a modernist writer in the way his poems are so dark and terrifying. But he's not hiding anything from anybody. Anyone who can read a Robert Frost poem. So I think there's just a kind of long and twisted ways in which all of the arts moved away from the general public in many ways. All of the arts essentially decided there was high art and low art, and there didn't used to be really that distinction. And you feel the same reaction when people go to a modern art exhibit. Their reaction is that, you know, either like, oh, my child could have done that, or they say, I don't understand it. And my response as far as art or writing is concerned is like there's nothing to understand. You either like it or you don't. You know, you just get it. You just do it.
Do you go by...
I go by Neil.
Neil. I'm going to ask you a very personal question. How old are you, Neil?
33.
You're married and you have three kids and you teach. At what point did Neil say, I'm a poet?
That's a good question. Neil played the tuba in college. That was what I did with myself. Seriously, played the tuba. I spent most of my time in the practice room, 8 hours a day, honking away at that thing. Maybe not 8 hours. That's what I told people. more like 4 to 6 hours. But you reach a point with an instrument there where you know if you're going to be good enough or not. And I realized that I just wasn't. Because I went to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and my schedule was very full with music, and I was also a history major. And I was never able to fit in the creative writing classes into my schedule. So I graduated with no job and nothing but a girlfriend. So she seemed like a good option. So I just followed her to where she was going, which was Providence, Rhode Island. I worked at Home Depot putting prices on things. And I decided I would spend my time reading and thinking about poetry because I never had in college. And it was something that always interested me.
Now, wait. Why poetry as opposed to fiction, creative nonfiction?
For whatever reason, poetry was always something that had been an interest of mine, though it wasn't something I ever pursued. You know, anytime there was a girl I was enamored with during college, I can find these like sheafs of 8 or 9 terrible poems that I wrote. And my parents actually recently brought to me a little book of poems that I had made when I was about 8 that I handed out as Christmas presents. And I do remember when I finished college.
Wait.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go too fast. We'll get back to finishing
college.
What do you remember liking about poetry? It would have to be before you were 8 years old.
Oh, it had to be before.
What was the attraction?
It must be. I mean, I was always been attracted to music. Music's always been in my family. So it must be the way that the language sounds is something that's been attractive to me. And the poets that are the most important to me, I think, are the ones for whom sound is a major component of the poems. Maybe a quiet major component. Somebody like Frost, somebody like Gerard Manley Hopkins. He's not maybe quiet, but sound is a major element of how the poems mean. And so I guess I've always been attracted to rhyming, as you can see in the book. And so maybe it must have something to do with music. And I guess I've always been attracted to writing as an enterprise. And I think when I finished college, I remember saying to Kate one day, I said, I don't know what I want to do, but I think I want to write stuff, something. I have 2 brothers, there's 3 of us. My older brother is a novelist. His first novel was published by Viking 2 years ago. And he's got another one coming out in 2014 with Algonquin Books. And my twin brother is a musician. He is a choir director up in Baltimore. So we're all, and a composer. So we're all creative, mm-hmm. which, you know, neither my parents do anything of that sort professionally. So it does seem sort of like it came out of nowhere. But I think the 3 of us would say that it didn't come out of nowhere, that we had creativity kind of in our house mm-hmm. from the beginning.
It was nurtured or fostered.
Yeah,
or,
always.
Or
I think always
the things
that we created and we sort of do on our own were always the things valued the most. Things like music lessons or things we would make or games we would invent. Those are the things that seemed in my memory to have the most value around our house. Whereas things, we all did play sports and do things like that, but none of us were very good. So that wasn't valued that much.
We left you in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
With your girlfriend, Kate.
Yeah, who's now my wife.
Who's now your wife right. And the mother of those 3 children, now those, roaring around Harrisburg.
3 wild children, yeah.
And you're putting price tags on goods at Home Depot.
Putting price tags on goods at Home Depot. Soon after that, I got into an office job, which was even more mindless. All I did was work during the day to make some money, and then I got pretty quickly to the point where I just thought about poetry the rest of the time. I would go to used bookstores and just stand in front of the stacks at the used bookstores. And I often tell my students this too. It was a kind of wonderful time because I can remember standing in front of the big shelves of poetry. Well, they probably weren't big, but as big as they get, and not knowing anything about the writers. Back then, I didn't know anything. So it was kind of a wonderful, innocent time where I just let poetry teach me about poetry as opposed to me thinking I know anything about it.
Perhaps I should let you know that Neil Perry teaches poetry at Hampton Sydney College in Farmville and just won the American Poetry Review Honickman First Book Prize for his first book, 9 Acres. I asked Neil to read a poem, any poem from the book, and then to talk about it.
I'll read one that that wasn't published in a magazine and has always, for whatever reason, been one of my favorites in the book. I don't know why. Maybe it was one of the later ones that I wrote, but the one Sewage Disposal on page 47. And perhaps this is the time where I should explain real quickly about the way the book is constructed.
Yes, please do.
The title would seem awful to anyone that didn't know. The book takes as its starting place a 30s agricultural manual, 5 Acres and Independence by M.G. Keynes, which is a pretty famous book in the world of self-sustaining and organic farming. Though the book is not organic, it does mention it a few times, but it has that sort of back-to-the-land ethos in it. And it has been republished with each consecutive back-to-the-land movement, and people have been interested in it. But I became taken with it as a kind of metaphor for self-sustainability in general, beyond growing vegetables and raising animals, which I'm also interested in. And so I saw in it a kind of liveliness and attentiveness to the way we live, almost at a, on a literal level and metaphorical level, that I really became sort of awash in the way the book was written and the way he made it sound so easy to just simply take care of yourself. And so what I did is I took each of the 52 chapter titles from that book and made them the titles of the poems. So that's where the strange titles come from. But anyhow, so this poem's called Sewage Disposal. In this chapter in the book, he tells you how to dig a septic tank, which is actually exactly how you would do it now, even though it was from the 30s. So, Sewage Disposal. There's a pair of wood ducks at the pond. They scare away each time I turn the corner to the berm that holds the water back from the woods. I've learned at least that when I yell at them to stay, their flight already past begun, their backs and scolding soaked with morning sun. There is a lasting echo. Wait, wait, wait. But it's always too late. I guess I've never seen them in an honest sense, if honesty is our endeavor here, though I'm not sure that's all we're good for, to flush and call after our shames. What could I admit to the ducks, the pond, that wouldn't come back the same?
All right. Talk about this poem.
Well, moments where the meter makes itself visible. In the first stanza, the second and third lines are extremely iambic.
You want to define that?
Yeah, for your listeners, they, of course, you'll remember your, but way back to your high school minds, you know, iambic pentameter is 5 feet. And an IM is an unstressed syllable followed by a stressed syllable. So essentially, the sound would be ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And these poems are all composed in tetrameter, which is 4 beats per line. You can hear a little bit in the first line. There's a pair of wood ducks at the pond. You hear that little anapest at the beginning, which is 2 unstressed syllables followed by a stressed. There's a pair of wood ducks at the pond. So that's an anapest and 3 IMs. But then it launches into a lot of straight IMs. They scare away each time I turn the corner to the berm that holds the water back. All that is IMs. And then another anapest to close it off from the woods. The contrast there, for me in the middle, when you hear all those IMs, it sort of rises up and you think, oh, this is something composed. And then it falls back into a kind of sound of natural speech. For me, that's the kind of effect I really admire in Frost, when you feel it sort of rise up and you feel it sort of feel the hand of the artist sort of maybe like flickering his little cigar for a moment, right?
You're aware that this is a poem.
Yeah, and then it drops back into by making what we would call a substitution of a change in the meter, which then is what makes speech sound natural. Because if we all talked in straight iambs all the time, we would sound like we were in a marching band. So it's that variation that makes the poem artful, right? But it's the way you can play with the way the meter sounds that really makes it sound like the way we talk. And, you know, I do some things that are unconventional, like there in that line where it says there is a lasting echo, wait, wait, wait. Technically, those aren't 4 feet. But because I'm letting that echo draw out, I'm asking the reader just to hear it as four stresses. So there's a moment, I think, where your expectations to hear a 4-beat line help you give the repetition of that word the weight that I want it, no pun intended. But this is not to say that I'm doing anything on the level of what Frost is doing in any of his poems.
But I mean, how much of your doing this is deliberate and how much is just that you're a poet and you write?
I think very little of a lot of those effects is actually deliberate. I think it's something you go back and fiddle with in revision for me.
Until it sounds right.
Mm-hmm. Most of these poems were composed in a, you know, a draft was nailed out in one go. I hit upon this form when my son, who's now almost 4, was an infant. And I can remember I decided I needed a form that I could knock a draft out in while he was taking a nap, a 30-minute nap. So I can remember sort of jouncing him with my foot in his little bouncy chair while I worked on the drafts of these. So I would kind of get them out as a single utterance, if you will, as a draft. And then in revision, I would start to notice the way the meter was playing across the lines. You know, I would make it right the first time through, make sure I got 4 feet per line and got the rhyme right. But then as I revised, I would iron out bits that didn't sound very natural, iron out bits where the meter sounded kind of tired, and try to make it sound as natural as I could within the confines of the structure.
How is your life different from mine because you're a poet?
How is my life different than yours? It's probably not substantially different than yours. You know, the vast majority of my time is spent managing more immediate concerns. I think what it is for any, for any artist, what they have in the back of their mind all the time is their art, right? It's not the first priority, but it's never a priority that goes away, right? You know what I mean?
It's like a pot simmering on the back of
the
stove.
That's right. Like the kids, of course, are the first priority. Then work, then you know, getting dinner on time and cleaning the house and making sure the garbage doesn't get attacked by skunks and all those things. But always in like the free moments, you know, after my wife goes to bed and I stay up for 30 minutes and I've done my work for the day, then I go and think about poems. Right. You know, we all, humans need obsessions other than their lives. And I think for me, it's just poems.
Yeah, strange things happen every day.
His next book, Nathaniel Perry says, which is in progress, is called Bizarre and focuses on the strange vacancies and fullness of parenting. It will be anchored by a long poem, also called Bizarre, which radiates around the story of an 18th century adultery scandal, which took place near Farmville, where he now lives. The Spark is a joint production of the WMRA Land Community and the staff at WMRA Public Radio.